We want to talk tonight about existentialism. So if you want to put that on your paper, if you haven't got it already. We're going to talk about existentialism. Now, this morning, we saw how naturalism automatically produces, logically, the doctrine of humanism. That if you believe that everything in the universe is only natural causes in a completely closed system with no supernatural, then you are limited to only the finite mind of man to be able to figure out everything that's going on in the universe. And when you're limited to the mind of man, you enter into tremendous philosophical problems, such as trying to find absolutes. You can't extrapolate an infinite universal to be able to give meaning to all the particulars in the universe. So, because you can't do that, you can't have absolute truth, right? Does that sound a little easier than it did this morning? Okay, because you've heard it all now. You don't have absolute truth because you don't have an infinite absolute reference point to compare things to. So everything becomes relative because it's based on your subjective experiences. You have no outside truth coming in. It only comes, your truth has to be what's coming from in here. And so it's subjective, so it's relative. And so then there are no absolutes, there are no categories, no real dog and non-dog, no real opposites, no antitheses. And so you have relativized metaphysics. Metaphysics has to do with what?
Being.
Relativized morals. It's okay, that's Winky Pratney's word stuff. it's better to use being, though. Because when you're out in the street and somebody's talking about metaphysics, it's better to use the word being than stuff. Okay? If you're going to talk on that level, you should probably use their vocabulary. Okay? Metaphysics, morals has to do with choice, and epistemology has to do with knowledge and the verification of knowledge. Okay, now tonight we want to look at what has happened chronologically and logically has come from the idea of humanism. First, naturalism was adopted. At the end of the Renaissance, humanism was developed as naturalistic humanism, atheistic humanism. And then we have a logical development down from that and the idea that there are no absolutes. Okay, so we'll start out with a chart. You might want to take a piece of paper, turn it sideways or something like that, unless you want to do a really cramped version halfway across across a page. No absolutes. Whoops, a little space here. When you say that there are no absolutes, you automatically have to say there are no antitheses. Or what? What does that mean? Okay, no antitheses. So you have A, which we'll call a thesis, an idea like good. And we'll have non-A, or the opposite of A, could be either one. Non-A, which we'll call evil, which is the antithesis. You have your thesis and antithesis. Now, all down through history, people have dealt with philosophy and thought. They've dealt with theology on the basis of thesis and antithesis. The idea being that there are real absolutes, and you must deal with those absolutes in your thinking and in your daily life. Your philosophy, your theology, and your daily life must deal with absolutes because that's the way God created the world. And so men, down through history, have had to deal with the issue of absolutes. However, because great problems enter in when you try to say that there are no absolutes, then men have tried to work in systems other than absolute systems at times. And we'll discuss some of those systems. Am I still there? Okay. Now, when you make a statement, a philosophically positive statement, such as, there is a God, that's a philosophically positive statement, then you can offer evidence to try to prove that there is a God. And you do not have to have an unlimited amount of evidence to prove it. You only have to have sufficient evidence because you have made a positive statement. However, and so you only have to offer enough evidence to show that there is a God. You understand? When you make a philosophically negative statement, there is no God, then it is impossible to prove because you have to offer an unlimited amount of evidence to prove it. And so it is impossible for the finite human being to prove a philosophically negative statement. Do you understand? When you say there is no God, if there is one place in the universe where you have not been, God might be there. If there's one experience that you have not had, it might be God. If there's one thing that you do not know, it might be God. Therefore, you must be everywhere, know everything, experience everything. See? You basically have to be God to be able to prove that there is no God. The finite mind cannot offer all of the evidence that is necessary to prove a philosophically negative statement. Now, that works not only with the idea of God, but with ideas like there are no absolutes. How do you know there's not an absolute on the other side of Mars? Maybe it's just because it's not in your experience. If there's anything that you don't know, that one thing could be an absolute. Understand? If there's anything that you haven't experienced, it might be an absolute. If there's any place that you haven't been in the universe, there might be an absolute there. So you cannot say, you cannot prove, there are no... When you have a philosophically negative statement, you cannot prove it. You really cannot offer empirical evidence for it because you have to offer an infinite amount of evidence to be able to prove it so. You understand? So philosophically positive statements are provable with evidence. Philosophically negative statements are not provable with evidence. So when someone says there is no God, they have no way to offer any kind of evidence. When we say there is a God, we had better be ready with the evidence. Because the burden of proof is on us. Now, a person who says there is no God can never prove it. See? And so they're not in a very good position either because they've made a statement that can't be proved. But when we say there is a God, we had better have some evidence to back that up. So, what is your evidence that God has invaded history and shown himself to be real? Okay? You think about that. You want a good book to read on that, you can read Evidence That Demands a Verdict by Josh McDowell. Well, I should say you can plow through Evidence That Demands a Verdict by Josh McDowell. It's not the kind, it's a resource book. It's not the kind that you just sort of sit down and read Sunday afternoon. Okay? It takes a while to plow through it, but it's very good to go through it. Okay. Now, there was a guy who came along, a philosopher, who said, well, we always have this problem when we try to say that there are no absolutes. We can't prove that philosophically. There's no way you can offer evidence for that. Consequently, if we tried to work in systems other than the typical thesis, antithesis, A, non-A ideas, then maybe we will get a little farther in our philosophy. Okay? And so he proposed that the world wasn't really composed, and things in the world were not composed of thesis and antithesis, but there always appeared to be some kind of a mixture of these two. And the word together in Greek is, synthesis. So, well, not synthesis, but sin. Okay? Thesis, ideas together. An idea together. And so instead of proposing the typical thesis and antithesis dichotomy, he said, let us have a synthesis and try to work on the basis of synthesis in our thought. There are different, of course, that's a very, very, simplistic way of presenting what Hegel was trying to say. But that was the philosopher Hegel. And he was very honest with it because he said, there really is no way that we can prove this absolutely because we are making negative statements. And so he was hopeful that someone would come along that would be able to handle that. He did not think that he had all the answers, and he was honest with it. Okay? And he proposed the idea that maybe there aren't real absolutes. Now, remember what this is all coming from. It's coming from the finiteness of the human mind, because when you have a finite mind, you cannot extrapolate an infinite universal. You can't come to the conclusion that things are absolute with a finite mind, because you're stuck with your own subjective experiences without revelation from another mind, without revelation from the mind of God. And so you're stuck with your subjective experiences, and whatever is subjective is relative. You need to get that in your head. Whatever is subjective by nature is also relative. In order to be absolute, it has to be objective. In order to be absolute, it has to be objective. Understand? Anything that's based upon subjectivity is always relative. Anything that's based upon the objective may or may not be absolute, but at least there's the possibility of its being absolute if it's objective. Okay, to us. Now, there was another guy who came along in the history of philosophy later, and he said that, well, it doesn't appear as if we can prove philosophically that there are no absolutes, that this is not real, this thesis-antithesis dichotomy. And so, but he said it does appear as if people actually live that way. In other words, the stuff of life doesn't seem to support the idea that everything is absolute. See? He said there seems to be in a lot of people a lot of gray rather than black and white. And things don't seem to always be so clearly black and white, thesis, antithesis. Now, the thing was, this guy was involved in the church, and so he put most of his words in religious terms, which made it, which makes it pretty tricky when you're dealing with his material, because he's almost always dealing with it in a religious sense. He's almost always talking about faith in God, that kind of thing. See? And so this fellow, he was Danish, that came along, proposed the idea that perhaps the way man lives shows that there are no absolutes, even if he cannot philosophically show that there are no absolutes. And so what he said was this, basically. Now, this is the main point tonight. What he said was this: because we cannot prove our philosophy with our minds, then what we will do is use a different criterion for the proof of truth, or developing truth. We will go on the basis of experience, separate from what logic and reason tells us. And he made a dichotomy between logic and reason and experience, or life experience. Okay? This guy's name is Kierkegaard. Kierkegaard? And he said, okay, that experience seems to tell us that there that the synthesis is true. And every time we try to use logic and reason, we get ourselves in trouble because of the finiteness of our minds. Which is true for the humanist. Every time the humanist tries to use his mind, it gets him in trouble because it's so finite. And so facing the problems of philosophy like that, what Kierkegaard opted for was experience separated from logic and reason, saying that what we need to do to come to the knowledge of truth, what we need to do to come to the knowledge of truth is have a first-order experience, in other words, a subjective, personal experience, that brings to us some kind of sense of meaning and truth. Now you see what he's saying about truth here? It's no longer based on objective revelation from God. It's no longer absolute, but truth is relative, subjective, and comes from your own personal experiences. That's how you develop truth. That's how you develop meaning in life. That's how you'll know who you are and what your meaning is through your own first-order existential experiences. This is what is called existentialism. This up here would be called existentialism on top. The experience of truth, or an experience that develops truth, gives you a sense of meaning in life. So he said, through experience, you will have truth, and there will be meaning to you. That will be different for every person, because it is a personal thing. Now, he called this, interestingly enough, he called this experience that you would have that would bring truth to you and meaning in life, since it is not based on logic and reason, he called it this, and he redefined a very important Christian word. He called it this. Have you ever heard that before? He called it a leap of faith. It is to believe, that is something that's totally separated from your mind. It's to have an experience, to believe that, now it's not a Christian term of belief, this is experience. To believe that there is meaning in life, even though logic and reason may tell you that really that's not so. Figure out with your mind where any kind of meaning would come from, but you take this leap of faith. You believe in spite of what your mind may tell you, that there is real truth, that there is real meaning in life. See? And in some cases you may even believe that there are absolutes, if that's necessary for your sense of identity. And so this leap of faith, or this first order existential experience, that's what he called it, a leap of faith. Now faith to him did not mean what it means to us. To us, faith is confidence. The Greek word means confidence. And it's placing your confidence in someone when you are convinced that their character is trustworthy. See? We have faith in God, which means what? We do what God tells us because we know that his character is worthy. He's worthy to be trusted. He is trustworthy. And so we choose to do what he tells us to do, even though sometimes the circumstances make it look like it's going to be impossible. He tells us to do it, and we know that we will be able to do it because he is trustworthy, and if he's told us to do it, we'll be able. As one black woman put it, if God tells me to jump through the wall, it's my responsibility to jump, and it's his responsibility to make a way through the wall. See? That's his responsibility, not mine. And I'll point out another thing here that you might find helpful. When we do things in faith with God, we have experiences with God, we never become irrational, which is against reason. Never, ever, ever do you do things that are irrational when you are a Christian, against reason. You do many things, however, that are supra-rational. That is, they're above your reason, but they are not contrary to reason in the absolute sense. You get the difference? They are above our reason because we don't have all the information that's necessary for it to be reasonable for us. But it is not irrational. If God says, go to Saipan, and you don't have the money to go to Saipan, that is not irrational because God owns everything in the whole world. Money is no problem for him. It is not irrational, but it is supra-rational. Because when you think about it with your own mind, where's that money going to come from? See? But when you say, God has said, then it's his responsibility, and so since he is great enough, he can take care of it. So it's rational, it's reasonable to trust God, but it is above our reason at times because we have to trust him for things that we can't see. Do you understand? So God asks us to be supra-rational in our supernaturalism, but he does not ask us to be irrational. Okay? And so when people say, well, sometimes God asks us to go against reason, that's not true. He doesn't ask us to go against reason. He asks us to trust him that and it's in his framework of reason and not ours. You understand? A supernatural framework of reason and not a naturalistic framework of reason. Okay. Get the difference? Sometimes people think that to live the Christian life, to be supernatural, they have to be irrational and go around doing irrational things. Well, in the absolute sense, no. But you do a lot of things that go against but go above your normal reasoning because God knows more than you do. So he tells you to do something, you go, okay. Okay. Because you know he'll come through because he's able. So this leap of faith has redefined for us a lot of things. Right? Do we take a leap of faith when we come to God? No, we shouldn't. Do we take a leap of faith? No. What do? We believe. See? Now, what does it mean to believe? It means to have faith, to place confidence in someone. God does not ask us, apart from any kind of logic and reason, he doesn't ask us to lay down our minds and, contrary to all logic and reason, sort of jump off of a cliff and expect somebody to be there. I've heard that illustration used before. That God just wants you to sort of step off the cliff and expect that he'll be there. Now, people don't normally go jumping off of cliffs expecting someone to be there. That is not faith. That is not faith. It's stupid to jump off of a cliff and expect someone to be there when there's no evidence that someone will be there. God does not ask us to believe in nothing. He doesn't ask us to believe in something for which there's no basis. See? He asks us to use our minds. He says, come now, let us reason together. Okay? And the end result of that may be that your sins will be white as snow. Okay? He says, present your strong arguments. See if you can find any fault in me. He asks us to come and reason with him. And he says, be sure what you're believing in. Test yourself. See if your foundation is firm. Okay? And he says, you are my witnesses, says the Lord, that you may know and believe and understand that I am he. First, know, then believe, and then understand. See, understanding very often comes after a commitment, after a choice. But knowledge will have to, some kind of knowledge is going to have to precede believing. What are you believing in if you have no knowledge of anything? If you didn't know anything about God at all, how could you trust in him? How can they believe in him of whom they have not heard? See, if you have no knowledge at all, how can you believe in him? Even the Bible says that. How can they believe in him of whom they have not heard? Right? They've got to hear something first. You have to have some truth. And now truth can come through the testimony of another person. See? When we go and witness, we're speaking truth to people. That is evidence on which another person, the preaching of the word, on which a person can base their faith. Because we are saying things like, well, because of what I've seen in the Word of God, because of what I have studied of Christianity, because of what I have seen in God's validation in actual everyday life, like seeing miracles, having your own life changed, being forgiven, and those kinds of things, that God is true to His Word. That's what you're communicating to people. And then if they trust you as a faithful witness of what you have seen and heard, then it's okay for them, on the basis of your testimony, which is according to the Word of God, it's okay for them to trust in God. You got that? Because we are witnesses of these things. And if we're preaching what we have witnessed, okay, of the truth, then it's okay for them to trust that, and trust us, and trust God, okay, place their faith in God. You get the difference? Faith does not have to be without a basis. People today, a lot of times, preach that faith doesn't have any basis. It's like you're just sort of jumping out there in the middle of nothing. Now, I've also heard the illustration that faith is like a little child who will jump off of a table into your arms. Faith is like a little child who will jump off of the table into your arms, never expecting that you will drop the child. Well, I'll tell you what. You get a child to jump off a table a few times and catch the child. Then, let the child jump off the table and land on its nose 3 or 4 times, and the child will stop jumping off the table. They're not dumb. See? The thing is, why does the child jump off of the table? Tell me. It trusts the person. See? There's some kind of a basis for the child to trust the person. The person is trustworthy. The person's never let them down. But when the person starts letting them down, they stop jumping. See? Kid's not dumb. Okay? So that's not a very good illustration, okay, of faith. It is a good illustration in the sense, if you stop at the first part, that the child jumps off the table because the child knows that they won't be dropped because you never let them fall before. See? Which is really hairy. I mean, I wouldn't suggest that, teaching your kid to jump off the table, because they don't have the comprehension when they're young that the parent is not always around. See? They might jump off the table when nobody's there. Flop. Floor. And they will learn by cause and effect that certain things happen, you know. Okay, it's interesting, the little kids don't know that their parents are not omnipresent and omniscient. They don't know that. They think their parents are always there and always know what they're doing. See? See? And we think that we're not teaching kids about God by our lives, huh? Okay. So, then, yes, this leap of faith is not a Christian thing, although people have taken the phrase and tried to adopt it into Christianity. It's not really a Christian thing. We do not take a leap of faith in the sense of trying to have some kind of an experience in order to give us meaning in life. We trust what God has revealed of himself and take deliberate choices of confidence in God. And that is what faith is. You get the difference? Faith has a basis and has an object in Christianity. In existentialism, faith has no basis and has no object. Faith is an experience. Okay, so with this division, as we have seen, truth is coming from experience. So truth is what? Truth is subjective. So truth is relative. So are young people who have been of our generation who have been taught this existentialism. That's what existentialism is, the idea that you develop your truth and your meaning in life through some kind of a personal experience that you have. Okay, that's called existentialism. So it's subjective and it's relative. And that's where we get words like doing your own thing. See? There are no absolutes. Everything is relative. that's your bag. This is my bag. What do they mean? You've got your truth. I've got my truth. See? Well, that's nice for you. But I have something else. It's nice that you have Jesus and you're satisfied with that, but I've got Buddhism, thank you, and I'm very satisfied with that. And what are they saying? There is no absolute truth. That's what they're telling you. And you need to go for the throat. You need to go for the presupposition and not go for the conclusions. I was talking to a guy on the street in Hollywood, and he would stop at the bus stop while we were down there witnessing every Friday, and so we just continued. Remember him? We continued talking to this guy, and I really started communicating with him one time when he said, well, I really believe that Buddhism and Christianity can go together. And I said, well, then what you're really telling me is that there are no absolutes. And he said, yeah, I guess that's what I'm saying. And then from then on, the whole thing broke open about the gospel. Are there absolutes or are there not? See, because if you say Buddhism and Christianity are the same, you have to say there are no absolutes because there are very definite differences between those two. Okay. Now, like you talk with a person who's into Baha'i. You know, 9 major religions of the world are all going the same place, right? Okay, if everybody is believing in the same God, and Hinduism says that God is infinite and impersonal, Christianity says that God is infinite and personal, Zoroastrianism says that God is limited and of a particular nature, both good and evil, involved in that nature. A dualism there. And Buddhism basically says that there is no God, at least the Buddha didn't know whether there was a God or not. Now, how do you put all those together and say that it's all the same? See, the only way you can do that is if you believe that religion is an experience. You get that? The only way you can do it is if you believe that religion is an experience, and it doesn't really matter what you're believing as long as you have a meaningful experience. See? That is existentialism. It is not Christianity. Does that ring some bells for you about from a lot of things that you've heard from people? Okay. Here's another one that gets into the Christian church. Well, I really don't think that, you know, your church is having an evangelism campaign. I really don't think that we should go out and try to tell people, other people, what they should believe, because religion is a very personal thing, you know. Oh yeah? Says who in the Bible? Religion seemed to be a very public thing in the Bible, didn't it? It was personal, but it was also very public. That you were to tell people what you believed, you were to stand up for the truth. And Jesus said, if you deny me before men, and silence is denial, if you deny me before men, I'll deny you before my Father in heaven. If you confess me before men, I'll confess you before my Father in heaven. See? So when people say, well, what are they actually saying? See? When they say, it's a very personal thing, and I don't think I should go try to tell somebody else what kind of experience they should have with God. What are they saying? They're saying that faith is a personal experience, but it's not based on anything. It's just a personal experience that you have that has no basis in logic and reason or fact. Okay? And you can't tell somebody else what kind of experience they should have because there are no absolutes, so you can't say the other person needs your experience. Okay, well, there'll be some other examples as we go, especially when we talk about religious existentialism. Okay, so there's a relativity of truth. A relativity of truth. Truth becomes relative because it's experiential. And there is a basic rejection of reason. See? There is a basic relativity of truth because truth is subjective. And there is a rejection of reason. There comes to be a very negative attitude towards the mind. A very negative attitude towards the mind is typical of existentialism. Now, through the last centuries, the real thinkers in the world almost always have been the Christians. The theologians have also been the philosophers. The division between philosophy and theology has basically happened in about the last 50 years. The roots of it were starting before that time. The roots of it started with Descartes, actually. But the actual outworking of that ended up in this century. The idea that philosophy and theology should be separate. That's a very recent phenomenon, and we should understand it's something that's happened in the last few years and not something that's been going on for a long time. The church, for centuries, has had the attitude that they should use their minds, they should apply their minds to the truth, they should be the thinkers, and they should be leading the world. Because if God is the truth, and He has revealed truth to us, we should be ahead of everybody else in thinking. In philosophy, in theology, in science, we should be ahead of everybody. Because if God is true, and He's revealed the truth to us in the Scripture, then we should be ahead of everybody. And so when you pick up Charles Finney, and you read Charles Finney, you know why it's hard to read? Because people back then thought like that. And we don't realize how much damage has been done in the last years in education, where people have not been taught how to read, how to think, how to reason. See? And that's because of the influence of existentialism in our culture. You have whole schools based on existentialism. The idea that you experience something, and out of that experience you develop your truth. Rather than the idea that a teacher can communicate objective truth to you in words, and you can learn that about the world. You get that? You went to a school like that, didn't you? Yeah. Okay. So, we have to be careful when we see this. It comes up in all different kinds of forms. Okay? And in the last few years, we've had the idea has crept into the church right out of our culture that has been influenced by existentialism. The idea has come into the church that Christians basically shouldn't think. And the negative attitude towards thinking comes not from the Bible. You want a list of scriptures? I'll show you a list of scriptures on the idea of knowledge and what God thinks of knowledge. The Bible says God is a God of knowledge, and by Him actions are weighed. And it is not good for a man to be without knowledge. The mind of the diligent seeks knowledge. Okay? I can give you a whole string of them that talk about knowledge and how we should be filled with knowledge. Okay? And yet people are against the use of their minds. And that doesn't come from the Bible. It comes from the existentialism in our cultures that says that truth will not come through knowledge. It won't come through logic and reason. It's going to come through experience. And this, of course, is why, starting in the 60s, we had a tremendous experience orientation in our culture. And people started to go into drugs. Now, why drugs? Well, because your mind is an electro... It's very simple. Your mind is an electrochemical agent. It works on electricity and chemicals. See? And there are two ways you can have an experience. Put electricity in your mind or put chemicals in your mind. See? And so it's very difficult walking around with electrodes connected to your head and a battery in your pocket to have experiences. It was a little easier to put some drugs into yourself and have an experience. Now, when the first people started taking drugs, I do not believe that many of those people were simply trying to escape. There were a lot of people along the way who were trying to escape. But the first people that started in the drug culture and promoted it were actually saying, we can find truth through our experiences. We can find reality. We can find meaning in life through the use of drugs, because drugs will help us to have meaningful experiences. You see? It's existentialism. Okay. So, what happens, well, by the way, once you, there's a thing like, it goes like this. It's what's commonly called the law of diminishing returns. Have you ever heard of that? The law of diminishing returns? That when you experience something, say you take drugs, that the next time you experience the same amount of drugs, you will not have the same experience. Because your system, and that's body, soul, and spirit, your system is able to respond with a little bit of resiliency to that impact from the drugs. And so the next time you take the same amount of drugs, you don't have the same reaction. Less reaction. Okay? And so you have to put more drugs in order to get the same level of experience. And that's how addiction takes place. You have to keep putting more and more and more in and more often to have the same experience. Because your body and your soul and spirit will learn to resist that. Okay? Called the law of diminishing returns. And what happens in experience, any kind of experience you have, you can have experiences, and then you'll have to have greater and greater experiences to have the same reaction. And that will happen with not only drugs, it will happen with things like Eastern religions, meditation. You have to have greater and greater experiences. Or in sex, same thing happens. See? Might get a real kick out of it the first time. Most primary sexual experiences, first sexual experiences, are not pleasant. Don't let anybody pull the wool over your eyes. Most primary sexual experiences are not pleasant. Okay? So that's why I think it makes so much sense to be married. Because then you've got the rest of your lives to worry about it, see? It just makes a lot of sense, right? Don't you think so? Hey? Yeah. Don't have a good time one time? If you don't have a good time one time, oh well, there's always next time, you see? See? We used to hang a sign over our bed that said, "In everything, give thanks." Because there were times when we simply had to give thanks. Anyway. Okay. Oh, well. You know. Carol thought that was a bit funny when she was single, and she heard it the first time, too. She went, "How can anything go wrong?" Lots of things can go wrong. Okay? But if you're committed to each other, you have whatever, how many years until you die to work on that, see? And you don't have to worry about it. Okay, no performance orientation. Don't have to perform if you're committed to one another. Okay? Right? Understand that? You don't have to perform when you're really committed to each other. Okay, where am I? Okay, yes, the law of diminishing returns. That even in sexual experience, you can have more and more sexual experience and you get less and less emotional and physical sensation in return from that. See? And what happens is if you keep feeding it over and over again and don't realize, like with the sexual thing, and you don't realize that the enjoyment and the pleasure of sex is really based on spiritual and psychological things. It's not based just on the physical experience. See? Why does sex get better the longer you're married and committed to each other as Christians? It does get better and better. It's not because the sensation physically becomes more intense. That's not it. It's because your relationship grows deeper and deeper as people. See? And so, they first went through drugs, they went through free sex, then went into Eastern meditation, and now people are going into what? The occult. Because they found out that the physical experiences didn't really satisfy, of drugs and sex. They're finding out that the mental thing of meditation doesn't really satisfy. And so what do? Move on into heavier things spiritually, into the occult. They're going for spiritual experiences. Now, isn't that interesting that they end up out here, the basic result of this experience orientation ends up out in the occult, which is what? Supernatural. And the very place that they started was by doing what? Rejecting the supernatural. And they come around full circle in the philosophy and experience back to the supernatural, but because they rejected the supernatural of God and the Bible, they do not come back to the supernatural of God and the Bible, but they do come back to the supernatural. See? But they come back to the other end of the supernatural. And the same philosophy and humanities teachers who a very short few years ago were teaching that there is no God, no, are now the ones teaching witchcraft classes. See? Having seances in the university. I was reading about Seattle University. There was a class that you had to bring bat's blood, wolf hair, and what was the other thing? Shark teeth or something? You had to bring those kinds of things to class. That was an assignment. Getting some bat's blood. And some wolf hair. Okay? So, consequently, the people have gone out into the occult. Now, on the other side, you've got people who get involved in logic and reason. There's always a division. When existentialism enters a culture or a group or society, there's always a division between the thinkers and the feelers, or those who are logic and reason oriented and those who are experience oriented. They swing to one or the other. Okay? Now, God doesn't want us to be one or the other. He wants to be both of these. He wants us to have meaningful experiences. He wants us to have that based on truth that is objective to us in revelation. Okay? So we're supposed to have reason and revelation together. Experience and logic and reason. Okay? So when you get into logic and reason, you get all the problems that we talked about under naturalism. You get things like materialism. evolution coming out of that. And the end result is that man feels basically meaningless. Because with his own finite mind, he cannot figure out what his significance in the universe is. And through logic and reason, he eventually goes out towards meaninglessness. Meaninglessness. Or, if you want to put it another way, as someone else has, these people become mystics, and these people become mechanists. Okay? Out into logic and reason, you become a mechanist. Okay? All you have is what the stuff of the universe. All you have is what is there to work with. And then the end result of that is, if you're really concerned about wanting to change the world, which many people involved in logic and reason are, in their sociology, anthropology, you know, humanities classes, philosophy classes, people are concerned about changing the world, and if you believe that man is only an animal, an accident from the great machine of the universe, then you see absolutely nothing wrong with manipulating man, either biologically, psychologically, physically. Right. See, absolutely nothing wrong with manipulating man and using violence, either psychologically, biologically, physically, on man. You find no reason why you shouldn't manipulate man, because man is only an animal. Man is only a machine. And the end result of that will eventually be violence of some sort. Manipulation, psychologically, biologically, physically, is a form of violence. Okay? Revolution, whatever. Whatever you need to change the world, whatever you think is necessary, you can do, because what morals are there to stop you? You don't have any morals. You don't need morals when man is an animal, when man is only a machine. Morals don't apply. You do whatever you want, see? You know why Stalin rejected Christianity? He said this. He said, "I don't reject Christianity because I think it's untrue, but because the person who is committed to the ideals of Christianity will not make a good revolutionary. Because they won't kill readily." He rejected it on practical grounds, not on philosophical grounds. He didn't think Christianity was untrue. He rejected it as a practical thing, because you can't make a revolutionary out of a person who's committed to forgiveness. See? Communists got very upset with Christians in Colombia. Gave them a very bad time. Marched them out of town sometimes at gunpoint, machine guns. Why? Because they were teaching the people to forgive. And it did not fit with communism. And so they said, "You're a threat to us, because you teach people to forgive." Okay, so you've got the mystics out on this side with their experience orientation, the mechanists on this side with the logic and reason orientation, and eventually leads out to violence. And Kierkegaard felt that with logic and reason, there would be no meaning in life and no truth in life. Now, most people do not understand that they are existentialists, because the existentialism has come to them in a very subtle form, and that is through music, through art, through movies, through the general culture, in advertisements, in the paper or magazines. It's come to them in such a subtle form, and it's in everything, that it appears as if that is the way life is. You see? And they don't realize that that is not the way life is. You ever listen to advertisements on the radio for things? You listen to these things and they go, and afterwards you go, "What did that say?" And you realize, it didn't say anything. Okay? Tell me, what is the objective definition and meaning of "Campbell's soups are good"? What's it based on? It's based on an experience. See? What a feeling. Toyota. Okay, they've got that in your head. Is a car a feeling? See? Would you buy a car based on what you felt like about the car? See? Normally, we would not do that. Some people might have the money to be able to do something like that. We certainly wouldn't. Okay? We would not run our life like that, buying cars on the basis of a feeling. And yet, that is exactly what everything is all based around in advertisement these days. Okay? Everything is based upon feeling. Okay? How you are going to feel. Oh, it's horrible. Okay, now I was going to give you an example. Yes, I was in a little town called Les Saints in Switzerland, up in the mountains.
And there is a university, well, not university, a college and a high school that is English-speaking, but the whole congregation, student body, is international. And a lot of them are the children of people that are involved in oil companies and other major corporations around the world. And so there's this whole conglomeration of people that are thrown together from all over the world, living together, going to high school and college. And the whole language was English-speaking, and so we could go there and witness to them. In the middle of Switzerland, we had all kinds of people we could talk to. So we would go up to this little tiny town. Where did that go? We would go up to this little tiny town in the Swiss mountains, and we would talk to these people. Excuse me. When I sniff because of my cold, you see, it just blasts him away. He's sitting there. Thinks the machine's falling apart. Okay. When we were up in the mountains, we would talk to these kids, and it was very easy to talk to them because they knew if you were not part of the school, because they knew everybody, because it was a small student body thing. And so they would walk up to you on the street and go, you'd be across the street, and they'd walk over to you and go, "Hi, who are you?" "Well, my name is Mike. What are you doing here?" "Well, you know, since you asked." And we had wonderful times of witnessing. Lord showed us all kinds of things in intercession, really specific things, you know, before we went. And I won't go into all that. But one time, we were out witnessing, and I was talking with one of the high school students on the steps of the high school. And for some reason, the high school cafeteria was open, and people were going back and forth out the door and in. And as I talked with this guy, I was trying to encourage him to think. I said, "Look, you need to use your mind. You need to think about the truth. You need to think about whether or not there's meaning in life. You need to think about absolutes. Is there a God? Is reality?" I was trying to get him to think, you know, use your head. See, these are really basic questions, really important questions. And you, even at this age, I think he was 17 or 16, I said, "You need to be thinking about these things." Trying to get him to think. And as I was talking like that, a guy walked past me, one of the high school students, and walked out, heard a couple of the words that I said, and he turned around and he said, "Man, I don't want to think. I just want to live life, because thinking is a dead-end street." You see what he was telling me? I just want to live life. I just want to have experiences. I just want to live. See, apart from logic and reason, thinking is a dead-end street. He was an existentialist, but if I had told him he was an existentialist, he would not have understood what I was talking about. He probably would not have known that word, see, unless he'd studied it somehow in high school, which was probably unlikely. See? He wouldn't have known, but he sure was one. Another time I was talking with a guy who said, "You know, I just really enjoy my girlfriend and my records," and it's a guy in the American military. "So I enjoy my girlfriends, my girlfriend and my records and my drugs, and you know, that's what I enjoy, just sort of, you know, so he was sort of cruising through life, that kind of thing. And we were walking along the sidewalk, and I said, I cheated, of course. I said, "God, what do I say?" You know, prayer. Of course, that's allowed in the midst of this warfare. I said, "God, what do I say?" And a little thought came into my head. And I believe it was from the Holy Spirit, but it goes right along with this teaching. That was, ask him if he ever thought that maybe truth could be something objective to himself. I thought, that's quite an interesting... I didn't know that this guy was a thinker or not or what, you know. So I said, "Have you ever thought that maybe truth could be something objective to yourself?" And he actually physically stopped. It got his attention so clearly. He just stopped, and he was thinking, and he said, "No, I haven't thought about that, but that's a very interesting thought." See? And then I went on to talk about how truth is objective to oneself, if it's really going to be absolutely true. Okay? So we need to learn how to work with these ideas.